Welcome to Friend of Maryland. My name is Kat Pause, and this is a fat-friendly space. Today on Friend of Maryland, I highlight a very important milestone. I chat with Michelle Allison from The Fat Nutritionist, and I spotlight a blog about obesity and naturalness. Welcome to Friend of Maryland. Friend of Maryland is a weekly fat positive radio show that airs on Access Manor 2, 999 AM, and then is podcast on iTunes. You can subscribe to Friend of Maryland on iTunes, and you'll automatically download when a new episode is posted. Today's episode marks a very special milestone for Friend of Maryland, as this is our 25th show. I can hardly believe that this is the 25th show of Friend of Maryland because part of me feels like I just started doing this yesterday. Especially when I make mistakes or shows don't go as well as I'd like them to, I feel like I'm a newcomer who has no idea what they're doing. But another part of me can reflect back and think about all of the great people I've had a chance to chat with, all of the cool blogs I've had a chance to highlight, and I go, yeah, 25 shows. That's pretty awesome. I want to send a huge thank you out to Access Manawatu 999 AM for giving me this platform to host a show, and especially to the station manager, Fraser, who was the one who approached me and asked me if I'd be interested in doing a show like this on Access Manawatu 999 AM. I want to thank my family and friends who've been super supportive as I've embarked on this new part of my journey in fat activism. I want to thank the people who are listening to the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We have listeners from all over the world, and that's just fantastic. And I think most importantly, I want to thank the people who've come on the show as guests. I've had such a great range of people from academics to artists to activists, and I really appreciate everyone who's been willing to give me some of their time to chat about the work that they're doing or discuss these important issues. A special thank you goes to the people who have been willing to be repeat guests. So that would be Marilyn Wan, the show's namesake, Kath Reed, Dr. Patty Thomas, and Brian Stewart, just to name a few. I hope everyone involved and everyone who listens enjoys what we do here at Friend of Maryland. And we're always happy to get your feedback. You can shoot us an email, friendofmaryland@aol.com. If you have any suggestions for the shows, any ideas for the shows, if you want to come on and be a guest on the show, just shoot me an email and we'll see what we can do. Here's to the next 25. Joining me today is Michelle Allison, the writer of the blog The Fat Nutritionist. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on Friend of Maryland.
Well, thank you for asking me to be here.
So you have a blog called The Fat Nutritionist, and I think for a lot of people, just kind of right off the bat of the title, fat nutritionist, might seem a bit like an oxymoron. Tell me about it.
Well, I chose the name specifically because I identify openly as a fat person, and that gives a little bit of an indication of my political sway, I guess, which is that I'm involved in fat acceptance. And I have a degree in nutrition, so they go together. Fat nutritionist.
Do you ever get kind of, you know, questions from people about, well, can you be fat and a nutritionist? Shouldn't a nutritionist not be fat?
I've definitely heard, I've heard that in the air. I've never had anybody come up to my face and say that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's nice.
probably because they knew bad things would happen if they did. But yeah, I've definitely heard that sentiment before.
So what kind of work is it that you engage in as the fat nutritionist?
Well, basically, I kind of live in a gray area between doing clinical nutrition as like a registered dietitian would do and doing sort of, I don't know, recreational nutrition advice. I work with average healthy women who have a history of dieting and want to give up dieting and learn how to eat normally. So that's what I focus on.
Is that a hard thing for a lot of women to do, to eat, as you said, normally?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's really difficult because there is a constant drumbeat encouraging women in particular, especially in the U.S. and Canada, which is where I'm based, encouraging them to give up eating, either a little bit or maybe altogether. So, yeah, they're constantly fighting against those messages and those pressures.
So the women who come to you, what are the reasons that they give you? Like, why is it that they've decided to try to get off this merry-go-round of having not the most positive relationship and maybe even an unhealthy relationship with food and their bodies and trying to want to shift to something else? Why do they make that decision?
Most of them make the decision because they are absolutely sick of dieting.
Mm.
They may still wish that they could have lost weight. They may still wish that maybe they will just lose weight by accident. But they have finally reached the end of their rope with regard to going on diets, cutting out different types of food, doing different exercise routines on top of it, and then actually finding that they can't maintain it permanently or that they even start to gain weight back while they're still restricting. Mm. So the people who come to me, they're just tired of it and they need to find out something different.
It's interesting. I have a lot of relationships with a lot of different kinds of people, including a lot of academics who study things like eating disorders and those kinds of things. And one of the things that they talk to me a lot about is in the sense of if you look at the cognitive structure mindset of someone who has an eating disorder and the cognitive mindset of someone who is engaged in basically kind of perpetual dieting. So whether this is someone who is always on a different kind of diet or someone who's managed to actually lose a large amount of weight and in order to maintain that has to remain kind of, you know, on this vigilant kind of thing, those cognitive mindsets look almost identical.
That does not surprise me, actually.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to hear that somebody's doing research in that area because, I mean, that kind of is what I would suspect just from my own experiences. A lot of the behaviors that fat people are prescribed for health reasons are actually quite disordered behaviors and mindsets that go along with it.
Mm. Yeah, no, there's that great, I think it's Deb Burghardt who asked the question of, do we prescribe for fat people what we diagnose as an eating disorder in others?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love Deb Burghardt, by the way.
I know, she's fantastic, right? Yeah, I've got to get her on the show. Like, I love her.
Great.
Okay, so you have women that come to you and say, okay, I'm ready to have a healthy relationship with food in my body. What kind of work are you able to do with them to help them in that?
I've been trained in a very specific methodology, I guess you could call it.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on research done by a dietitian named Ellen Satter, and her sort of paradigm is called eating competence. And it's the idea that there are four specific factors that go into making up sort of, I guess, normal, healthy eating. You can think of it that way. And there's a systematic approach to getting people to stop dieting, to set aside weight loss concerns in favor of practicing self-care around food specifically. So that's how I do it.
Does the concept of intuitive eating, does that come into play in the work that you do? Because I've seen a lot about that lately.
Yeah, it's sort of eating competence is basically an intuitive eating approach. It's
okay.
Just sort of its own special little thing. A lot of intuitive eating approaches are based on what's called demand feeding. Anybody who's read stuff by Hirschman and Munter, like Overcoming Overeating and When Women Stop Hating Their Bodies, that stuff is based on demand feeding, which is basically how babies eat. They get fed when they cry, and they stop eating when they're full, and they eat as many times and as much as they need to. Eating competence is not a demand feeding approach. It places a bit of structure in terms of regular meal times, pre-planned meal times, around eating so that within that structure, you eat as much as you want, you eat what you want, that kind of thing. But because adults don't have the they don't have the luxury of having a mommy near them to feed them whenever they cry, they kind of have to pre-plan things a little bit and live in a real world where there are sort of set meal times. So that's the major difference.
And I would imagine, too, that actually for most people who are coming from a diet mentality, that competent eating – that's the right phrase, competent eating?
Yeah.
Okay. Is not as scary, if you will, as intuitive eating. Because as you say, like it still allows to have kind of a structure and sense of, okay, you know, three meals a day and those kinds of things. So there's still structure built into it. Because I know when I talk to people about intuitive eating – It scares them, like this idea that they would actually trust their bodies and start tuning in really to their bodies in terms of what it is their bodies want, when it is their bodies want it. That's just such a foreign idea, to especially to adults, that I would imagine that competent eating, you know, it's still obviously an excellent, you know, health step towards health and developing that health, but maybe not as intimidating as really trusting yourself, which for whatever reason we don't think we can do.
I mean that's kind of the reason I found this particular theory. When I stopped dieting myself, I tried to do the demand feeding thing, and I read the books on intuitive eating, and I found it really difficult just to have no structure whatsoever and to try to listen for hunger signals that had long since
had beaten out of yourself for over 20 years.
I had ignored them for so long that they didn't really exist except in the form of desperation, which, you know, drives you to a type of eating that's not exactly normal either. It's desperation eating. So I went through the same process with a dietitian who was trained in it, and it really helped me to actually develop hunger signals and fullness signals again, and to also give some thought to the nutritional quality of my intake without it becoming sort of a health project or a diet project.
Or like morality. So this is good and this is bad.
Yeah. Exactly. Because it's more based on what mix of foods actually makes you feel good versus, you know, which rules are you following or failing to follow.
So I have to admit, like I've known about you quite peripherally for quite a while. But somebody tuned me into a really recent post that you wrote called Feeling Fat, that I think was actually just published like on the 20th of February. So, you know, it was really recent. And I have to say, like, this has become like one of my favorite blog posts of the year. So, you know, you're welcome. I mean, not that that means anything coming from me, but, tell me about, I mean, this piece, Feeling Fat. Talk me through it.
I guess it came up because not only do I have these feelings and things that occur that make me question, you know, whether I'm doing the right thing or thoughts that come up that make me feel like my body is not acceptable and, of course, I should be doing, you know, something to lose weight because I get that message just as much as everybody else does.
Yeah.
But I also, I wrote about this topic because I literally sometimes have to take my own clients through this process of asking, what does it mean to feel fat?
Right.
And then finding out everything else that's under there in an attempt to actually find a way to deal with it rather than having this sort of knee-jerk reflex of going back into the diet cycle.
Well, and I would imagine that for anyone who is a, you know, a practitioner of health like you are, but even people who aren't, you know, kind of working with others just on their own level, engaging in that kind of, I would call it unpacking, I'm sure there's a lot of other words for it, would be really helpful, you know, because as you say in your post about, and I think I definitely experienced this as well, and sometimes when I do media, they ask me about this, like, you know, so are you body positive all the time? You know, and of course, part of us wants to be like, well, of course we are, you know, because they put us up on these pedestals, you know, like we're the, you know, the spokesperson or, you know, the role model to look up to. And in some ways, I guess we are. But I think it's important that, you know, there's a space that allows us to say, well, of course, I'm not body positive all the time. I have bad days, or I wake up some mornings and I look in the mirror and I'm like, ugh. And that's for a variety of reasons. And I think what about your post really spoke to me is you had this idea of feeling fat. Well, obviously, fat's not an emotion. So what does it mean when we think that way, or, you know, when we hear a woman says it, oh, I feel so fat today. And Yeah, so I thought that what you did in that post was, was really moving and a really important piece that isn't always necessarily added to the conversation we're having, partly because we're always trying to be so positive and progressive about it.
Right. Yeah, and I find that a really important piece of it, too, and this is going to sound totally paradoxical and weird, but I find that for my own process of self-acceptance, it's actually really important for me to accept and sometimes even engage with the urge to go back on a diet, even though it's something that I have not done in 12 years now. I've kind of never given in to the impulse, but I think part of that is because I allow that impulse to exist.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to banter with it in a way and analyze it and think about it and feel it rather than just trying to shut it down and be like, no, I must be, you know, body image Iron Woman or something. So I also wanted to, you know, sort of open up and show people what that process looks like.
Which was a really brave thing for you to do, by the way. Like, I'm sure you already know that, but again, I mean, in this kind of thing, we always take a risk when we're willing to, you know, kind of engage with those more areas of ambivalence, if you will.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate the people who are like, no, don't make that public because that's what the haters are going to grab onto and say, see, even your most staunch advocate and activist, you know, says these horrible things and, you know, really wants to be doing something different. But right. I think that if our movement is going to grow and going to continue to reach more people, we really do have to allow ourselves those times of ambivalence. And as you said, like for you, engaging with that ambivalence is what allows you to kind of emerge out the other side even stronger. And I think that's probably true for most of us.
Yeah. And I tell you, as many times as I have gone through this thought process, I think that it has helped me to understand through practice and actually breaking down in sort of a rational way, what does this mean to feel fat? It's helped me to understand it better when it comes up again. And because I live in this culture, this is never just going to go away.
Right.
I'm always going to have some incidents where I feel unwelcome or undesirable or just, you know, not like I'm part of everything with everybody else. And oftentimes, because I'm also subject to the same bias that everybody else is, I'm going to interpret those experiences as, you know, my bad fat body.
Right.
So.
Awesome. So, Michelle, if there are people that are out there listening who are like, oh, I really want to get in touch with her and find out more about her work or see if I can get her to help me, how can they do that?
They can go to my website, which is www.fatnutritionist.com. Or they can email me. My email is Michelle, which is MICHELLE @fatnutritionist.com.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking to us about your work.
Sure. Thank you so much for asking me. It was really fun.
Yay. Well, we'll have you back again soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Spotlight today is a piece from the blog What Sorts of People. The piece is entitled Obesity and Naturalness, and it was written by Kristen Rodier, published February 22, 2012. Quote, high-profile anti-obesity activist Mimi Roth writes on her blog, let's finally recognize obesity as abuse. Abuse of our children, abuse of ourselves, and together take action. Roth has recently trademarked the term secondhand obesity, playing on secondhand smoke. She writes that secondhand obesity is passed along from parent to child and from citizen to citizen. Roth makes numerous television appearances every year and continually underlines the association of fat with sickness, death, and unnaturalness. New research by Dr. Ira Sharma is beginning to break the elision of fat and sickness with his new research. Quote, the back-to-back studies come as more evidence emerges that a significant proportion of overweight people are metabolically healthy and that the risks associated with obesity do not make for a one-size-fits-all formula, end quote. If the risks associated with obesity are less dramatic than once believed, then what is feeding the culture of obesity panic that aims to blast away fat and burn belly fat away in 10 days or less? What surprises me about much of the writing on obesity, like Roth's and Richard Carmona, the Surgeon General of the United States who compared the obesity epidemic to terrorism, is that it seems to operate under two very mistaken assumptions, that obesity is unnatural and that obesity is historically new. First, there's a lovely new book out by Sander Gilman, Obesity, the Biography, wherein he tracks the historical meanings and classifications of obesity and shows that there have been obese people in all cultures and in all historical epochs. Much like mental illnesses, obesity was not divvied up into multiple medical categories in ways that could resemble an epidemic until our present and constantly changing classificatory systems. Much anti-obesity rhetoric assumes that the body's natural state is thin and that through mass agriculture, poor food choices, high stress, and so on, we make our bodies fat. This preserves the nature-culture divide by attributing the fat-on-fat bodies to over-industrialization and Western excesses. To deal with the second assumption, that obesity is historically new, we can look at the term globesity, which is largely defined as the exportation of obesity from the West to other countries. Globesity maintains and exacerbates racist imagings about Eastern cultures, that they don't get fat, that they are pre-Western excess, or paradoxically, that what occurs in their culture is due to Western influences. If they have fat people, it must be due because of Western imports like KFCs, McDonald's, etc. This Western-centric worldview imagines Western expansion and American exceptionalism by painting progress into the future as decidedly Western and white. The assumption that Eastern parts of the globe don't have fat people because they do not suffer in Western excess maintains the racist assumptions that the East is closer to nature, simple, and living in the past. Self-help literature on fat tends to perpetuate the assumption that the natural body is the thin body, as well by arguing that if fat people listen to their body's natural hunger cues, that they will naturally lose weight and find their natural and much smaller weight. With sympathetic intentions, self-help literature perpetuates the idea that fat-on-fat bodies is unnatural and by extension unhealthy. As I'm sure many of the readers of this blog are aware, the term health and natural are used in so many ways to mobilize the kinds of people we are supposed to be. Dr. Sharma's new research allows that there can be fat bodies that are healthy, which will perhaps expand what is thought of as a natural and normal body. This is what makes his research so radical. Dr. Jennifer Cook, a researcher applying Dr. Sharma's new research, said, "Just because you're normal weight doesn't mean you're healthy. You can still have high blood pressure, you can still have diabetes, you can have a poor lifestyle, and all of these contribute to obviously negative health and early mortality risk. You really need to take the emphasis off trying to attain this normal body weight, because lifestyle practices are equally, if not more, important." There is much more to discuss pertaining the assault on fat people via obesity panic, but I hope to have shown the problematic associations of the thin body with nature, because the fat on fat bodies is just as natural as lesser amounts of it on thin bodies. Gilman, in his History of Obesity, has argued convincingly that obesity is no crisis, but rather the most recent version of an obsession with bodily control in society and the promise of universal health through all forms of medicine. End quote. Thanks for tuning in to Friend of Maryland. Friend of Maryland airs weekly on Access Manawatu 999 AM in Palmerston North, New Zealand, and is also podcast on iTunes. If you'd like to get a hold of the show, you can email us, friendofmaryland@aol.com. You can also check out our Facebook page and the blog, friendofmaryland.com. Closing the show is Adele with Don't You Remember.